felon, nay.
Exactly. It's a crime. They also set the voting machines, the ballot counting machines, in predominantly white counties. They were set in a way that if you put in a bad ballot, a spoiled ballot, it would kick it back at you and say, this is wrong, you got to vote again. In the predominantly black counties, they had it set so that the ballot would be accepted, it wouldn't be counted, and the voter wouldn't be told that it wasn't being counted. So literally thousands of black voters, who are mostly going to vote either Nader or Gore, got eliminated from it. When you have a few hundred votes difference, then there's the second piece. There were 170,000 ballots that weren't counted because of the chads being dented or, you know, one corner hanging off, whatever. The New York Times, Washington Post, Miami Herald, a whole bunch of media companies formed a consortium. They went, they took the 170,000 ballots, and they did 9 statistical tests on them. One, if the Florida Supreme Court's first decision had ruled, if the Florida Supreme Court's second decision, if Gore's strategy, if Bush's strategy, 9 different ways. 6 of the 9 gave it to Gore, 3 of the 9 gave it to Bush. And the way the media reported the story was, oh, well, Bush won. Excuse me, but my math tells me if 6 of 9 say Gore won and 3 of 9 say Bush won, Bush ain't the president. And then he had to have the Supreme Court hand the presidency to him. So this is very sketchy stuff.
We, A, I, we aired, A, V, a video. On V, on voting fraud.
Yeah, it wasn't just Florida. Chicago and
this
a lot
was like
of other
before,
places.
This was a video that was done before this presidential election, and it was a video on voter fraud five years before this.
Yeah.
And in Florida. And they show his crew going into a room where there's all these little old ladies counting votes, and they're just like
slinging
indiscriminately, you know, yeah, like picking and choosing which goes where.
Well, my wife, Medea Benjamin, she was running for the Green Party. She was running for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein on the Green Party ticket. She went down there immediately to mobilize people because the right-wingers, the Republicans, had their people out in force, and they were, like, intimidating the vote count and stuff. And she went down and she said, well, is it only Republicans and Democrats who get to be in the counting room? I'm a Green Party candidate for the U.S. Senate, do I? And they said, oh, yeah, I guess so. And she got in there. And she said you could see it was so half-assed the way they were doing the whole thing. Here's the presidency of the most powerful country in the world hanging in the balance. And there's all this, like, jockeying and finagling going on. And then the presidency gets handed to this guy who doesn't read books. And the public is okay with that? That really scares me. The scariest thing is that the public doesn't go out in the streets and rebel against it.
Why? Why didn't Gore do anything?
That's a very good question. The Democratic Party, not just Gore, but the Democratic Party, what they did was they took a legalistic strategy. They're all lawyers. So they said, oh, no, let's stick to the courts. And it's this don't rock the boat kind of philosophy. If you go back and look at the photographs of the Republicans that were out in the hallway banging on the door and doing all this pressure on the vote counting, the people have published these photographs, and they can pick out and identify this one is an aide to Republican Congressman so-and-so. This one is a Republican staffer of Senator so-and-so. They're all paid Republican staff people that were out there as like a goon squad putting pressure on the vote counters. Because they, you know, they knew what was at stake. They didn't want Gore's votes to be counted. Not to mention the Palm Beach County ones. Jews for Buchanan, all these Jewish voters who supposedly voted for Buchanan. Not likely, but the way the ballot was rigged, you had elderly people who would have voted for Gore or Nader ended up being counted for Buchanan.
Was Gore, J, just... D.
Dumb. Stupid. I think it's a combination of both. I think that there's a structural phenomenon of guys who are inside the palace and are part of the game. It's why the Clinton administration gave Jesse Jackson a job in the State Department as a roving diplomat. Because there's this saying, better to have him on the inside pissing out than on the outside pissing in. And within those ruling circles, I saw this when I lived in Washington for 5 years, within the ruling circles, disagreement goes so far, but questioning the system and real basic things, no, then the criticism stops. If you want to have a career, and Gore was planning for the future, figuring, well, I can run again, even if they screw me this time, I'm going to do well. He's very well paid. He can go out on the lecture circuit and get $50,000, $60,000 for a speech. So they're playing that safety thing of stay within the palace grounds.
For H, for G, E, N, generations, E, T, I, genetic, C, C, O, M, companies. Oh, he's doing stuff for genetic companies, Gore?
Well, you got to remember that when the South Africa case came up, the South African government had affordable AIDS drugs that they could produce on their own, as does Brazil, India, a lot of third world countries. What's being pushed for in the World Trade Organization is real strict limits on the ability of third world countries to produce their own drugs. They wanted to be bought from the big pharmaceutical companies. On Gore's staff, very high up on his staff, were people from the pharmaceutical industry. So he was opposing, when he was vice president under Clinton, he was opposing the right of South Africa and other third world countries to produce their own generic drugs for AIDS and other things, when, of course, it's more affordable that way, and instead saying, no, we got to have global rules that will prevent them from doing that. So you see, there's a very interesting thing going on here. When they're protecting the profits of big transnational corporations, that's patent rights and intellectual property rights. It's not called protectionism. When we try to protect workers or the environment, we're protectionists. Protect is a positive word.
Who?
There's nothing negative about that word.
Is. Who is the R E A real G L O global globe global M O V movement, not them. Who is the real global movement, not them?
Well, what you got going on, I think, is what when they say in the press globalization, they're talking about elite globalization, top-down globalization, the globalization of the big corporations, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. It's money values. There's another globalization, though, that we're doing in the global justice movement, the environmental movement, coming up from the grassroots saying, wait a minute, we're going to replace your money values and violence with life values and nonviolence. And if you go out to a general public audience, I do this all the time, I say, which is sacred, commerce or life? Should you subordinate life to commerce, which is what the guys ruling the planet now say, or should we subordinate commerce to life, human rights and the environment? Most people know the right answer to this. Once you answer that question, capitalism and the whole ideological underpinnings of the system start to fall away like sandcastles on the beach that get
yes.
hit by a wave.
Yes.
So it's important, I think, when people use the term globalization to say, which globalization do you mean? Do you mean the top-down elite minority globalization of the bankers or the bottom-up people's globalization?
A. K. A. Also known as I M P E R
imperialism.
Sure.
Yeah. And this is what we've got to make people in this country understand in particular is the United States, we the people of the United States, the citizens who are supposed to rule over the government, we're the fourth branch of government that's supposed to rule over the other three. We have to make a transition in this country from being an empire to being just another nation in a community of nations. What's going on right now with the Bush administration is this, you're with us or you're against us, take it or leave it, it's our way or the highway. And what it's doing, I was just over, just a few days ago, I was in Amsterdam meeting with a bunch of European groups. It's not playing well in Europe. We're being laughed at. We're being mocked as a people, as a nation. People are saying, how could you possibly have somebody so stupid taking you in this unilateralist direction, get in behind us, you know, we're going to kick ass on all these countries. It's not playing well, even among the bourgeois elites in the corporate world in Europe. They're going, whoa, wait a minute, you're going to screw up the whole game here. We had a pretty good thing going in terms of, you know, redistributing global wealth toward us, and here you are heavy-handed coming in, you got to follow us or else. You could screw up the whole thing. And it's really scaring a lot of people. People up in pretty high power circles up in the top of the pyramid. So people in the U.S., what we do at Global Exchange is we try to get people here in the U.S. to pay attention to what people outside are thinking and what people outside are saying about us, because we have a lot to learn from that.
How did you, how did a P, you, a punk like you.
A New Jersey punk. Hey, I used to talk like this.
Get in to this.
That's a good question. Let's see. How far back should we go? My parents were not very well-schooled people. They were really poor. My dad worked his way up to being a bus driver. He was an illiterate Irish peasant, never got a chance to go to school. My mom made it to the eighth grade. So for them, education and reading was important because they had been deprived of it. So they really impressed on us, you got to get an education, you got to read, read, read. And my brother got a PhD, and I got a PhD. And I think it was because of that, you know, that sense of support and this notion that you can be anything you want to be. And then I turned 18. It was in 1968, right after the Tet Offensive, when all my buddies are coming back from Vietnam in bags with their heads blown off and legs blown off. And my government says, time for you now. And they try to draft me. And that really woke me up, and that radicalized me. The first anti-war demonstration I went to in New York, we got attacked by the police. A buddy of mine got his skull cracked open by a nightstick. You know, those kind of things really focus your attention. When your life is at stake, when you're physically threatened, all of a sudden that focuses your attention. So I started paying attention to the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement. And that reading books and traveling, I started traveling to Puerto Rico, Northern Ireland, Southern Africa, Central America, and just listening to people, because my dad always impressed that on me. He's like, he would say, you can learn something from anybody. Don't look down at that wino laying in the gutter. You can learn something from him. And just paying attention to people and asking them questions, and that gradually radicalized me. The reading books and traveling and listening to people, I think it'll radicalize anybody if you let yourself hear what's out there, if you really pay attention. If you do this, then
not
no hope.
T-O-U-R touring S-M touring tourism, not traveling, not tourism.
One of the things that we do in Global Exchange is what we call reality tours, and this is like reverse Club Med. You know, get people off the beach, go out and meet real people, and we do probably about 60 trips a year. We do about 40 trips a year just to Cuba. And you take people to Cuba, is probably the country where the gap between what people think is there and what's really there is the greatest of any country. They go there and they realize, oh, this place is not a hell. These are actually nice people. They're intelligent, they're literate, they're critical of their government, as all people should be. They're very fun-loving, open. They want to be friends with us. Sure, they're critical of our government. We all should be. And we should be critical of all governments. And what we see in our tours is when you take people to other countries and you introduce them to real people at the grassroots and they get to talk to them and hear their perspectives, the first thing they learn is not about that country. It's about here. It's about the United States. It's that they've been lied to, that our leaders in the media and the government have lied to us about what's out there. They want us to be fearful. Ooh, they're the enemy. No, they're like us.
They
are you and I dressed differently.
It is a S H E shelter? No, S E H shell. A shell game.
Shell game. Sure. Yeah. It's, if you think about the way magicians work, most magician stuff is misdirection. They're going like this, and the real trick is happening down here.
Yeah.
So they're putting out all this, you know, Super Bowl, World Series, this, that, and the other thing, all this flash bang, whiz bang, you got to have Nike sneakers, you got to have a Lexus car, blah, 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 blah. Telling people that success as a human being is the quantity of things you own rather than the quality of your relationships with people and the environment. And if you get people misdirected like that, you can pull all sorts of scams. But the proof that it's wrong and not the way to go is, if it were normal and natural for people to orient their lives around consuming commodities, you wouldn't need to hit us with thousands of commercial messages a day. You would occasionally say, go shopping. Oh, yeah. And we'd all run to the mall. What's normal and natural is to focus on family and community and caring and love and togetherness and solidarity. And they have to bump us out of that normal organic track into this treadmill. Oh, I got to go to the mall to get that new piece of garbage to put in the garage that I have to have a yard sale every week to get rid of the old crap to make room for the new crap.
And
then you're on a treadmill working a job you don't enjoy to pay for it.
M-A make you think you don't have P-O power.
Yeah.
You until UN unless you G O go T H through there C H A channels.
Sure. Yeah. Over this way, folks, get in line, go right through this portal over here and pay us your admission. It's like Disneyland. That's what our politics is. You know, it's like a Disneyland politics. It's not hands-on people controlling it. It's people relying on the people in power. We'll choose candidates for you, and you can have this rich white millionaire corporate trade lawyer, or you can have this rich white male corporate trade millionaire lawyer. Well, wait a minute. How about somebody different? How about somebody that's going to be critical of corporate power? And that's what I think we got to get at. In our work at Global Exchange, we do a lot of work on the corporate takeover of government, not just national government, but global government, the World Bank, the IMF, World Trade Organization. That's global government. It's secret global government. And even right-wingers will agree that if there's going to be global government, it shouldn't be secret. It should be out in the open. So these guys are really vulnerable. They've done a scam. They've done a little, you know, magician's game of hiding the truth from us, and we've got to reveal it to people to empower them.
They are the very fragile.
Sure. If you think about this, they've already lost. At these protests that we do outside the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, we put tens of thousands of people outside those institutions so that they have to spend April 2000, they spent over $7 million just on police, thousands of police out there, to have a little weekend meeting. Now, what does it say? If my organization had to spend millions of dollars just to have a board meeting, what would that say about our credibility? We've been trying. There's a bunch of groups that have been trying to get the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to debate us on TV for 8 months now. We've been begging and pleading and come on. They have thousands of PhD economists. We got the BBC and World Link TV to agree to a global broadcast. They'll foot the bill for the production costs. You think the World Bank and IMF will agree to it? No, they won't. So what are they afraid of? They say we don't know what we're talking about. If we don't know what we're talking about, blue hair, nose rings, bunch of kids. Okay, then show us. Come kick our ass on TV. They won't do it. They're afraid of us.
Don't see O N T control World Link and BBC.
Exactly. And what we're saying to them is, look, we'll have fair, neutral people running the questioning, and we'll just go at it.
Are you kidding?
Well, no. What they want is, they want the kind of McNeil Lehrer softball, throw it up to. In fact, in April 2000, when we did the big protest at the World Bank and the IMF, the McNeil Lehrer Report producers called us and said, look, can you people put up two two representatives of the protest movement to debate the World Bank and the IMF. We said, yeah, sure. Juliet Beck from Global Exchange and Vandana Shiva from India, both very smart women, said, okay, fine. They go on there. The World Bank IMF people would not appear on the same show. They said, you have to have two shows, one for us and one for the protesters. Well, what do you think? We're going to pie you or something? I mean, what are you afraid of, right? But they didn't want to be subjected to our questioning and criticism because they know the TV commentators are going to play it nice because they're dependent on corporate advertising, right? So you see that we've already won at the moral and ideological level, we've won. They've got the guns and the money, yeah, and that's powerful. But we've got facts and moral authority and potentially the majority of people on the planet on our side. They're a small monocrop. We're biodiverse.
That we, H, A, had, A, V, E, very, I, N, interesting, T, talk, with, I, O, our, S, O, N, our son. He's 27, 28, yeah. Well, we said, how do you, he's politically active.
Good. That means you did a good job raising him. Right?
We got nervous in high school. He got real straight.
Well, you always think, I have two daughters. One is 21 and one's 11. And, you know, you worry because if you push your politics too hard on them, they'll end up being Republican stockbrokers or something like that. So you got to be careful.
In high school, he got real straight. Started gelling his hair, wearing logo clothes.
I think they do that just to scare us. It's like, I'll freak my parents out. You know?
Then he went to college in Santa Cruz, and then he started showing up with rings all over, the piercings, long hair, and you know, now he's very active in politics. Right. And but we said, okay, so what do your friends think about is it going to take a revolution, you know, to make things different, or you know, how's it going to go? So.
Well, that's what it took for the United States to get its independence from King George, a revolution. He? This country was founded on a revolution.
He said, M-U-S, must, M-O-S, most, want, R, A, radical change. Most of his friends want radical change, but they think that would lower their quality of life substantially.
Well, I lecture a lot on college campuses, and what these kids are being taught is focus on job, focus on career. So if you say to them, and I do this, I say, okay, I want you to raise your hands. I'm going to give you two reasons for you being in college. First, I say, to get a high-paying job. 90-some percent of the hands go up. Then I say, to find the meaning of life. And a few hands go up. And I say, wrong. You know, here's the one chance you have outside the slipstream of funding and raising money and all this, to figure out what life is about. And instead you focus on getting some stupid job. Make yourself a labor commodity to sell to some corporation.
This is K O K I D, kids who are a radical. The koalas. So when he's asked talking about his friends, these are radical kids already that think that they want change, but the quality of life.
Well, if you look at the troops in this movement, the shutdown of the WTO up in Seattle. Yeah, it was trade unions and environmentalists, but the troops, the foot soldiers, were young people. The World Bank IMF protest, the protests in Genoa, all these different protests around the world. It's the younger generation, which to me, at 51 years old, it's really good to see that they're ready to take the baton from us And we can play a facilitating role and give advice and things like that. But they're ready to take charge of the movement, and I think that's a really good thing. I think we have to start handing it over to them and encouraging them.
But if they, J, B, E, if they believe the L, the lie, that radical change equals a substantial lowering of the quality of life.
Well, this is why you got to help people get out of this individualistic framework, me. You need a we ideology, not a me ideology. And what I say to them is, look, you can approach this as an individual and think about your income and your little house and your swimming pool and your minivan and that kind of stuff, things, or you can think of yourself as playing a role in changing the course of history. After you die on your deathbed, don't you want to look back at your life and not see a bunch of stuff, but look at the fact that you may have changed the course of human development and human society and have a lot of people saying, boy, the world's a better place for that person having been alive. Given that choice, most people are going to make the right choice. Our job as educators and activists is to create options and help them see their options. I think that's what empowerment is, helping people see, look, you do have options. You may think you don't, but you do, no matter how hard you've been repressed. There's always options. You have choices in terms of different directions. And that's our job as activists, is trying to create the visual of those options.
I and give and think. N, I, Nike, S, shoes, C, O, S, cost, us, 200 times what it costs to make them.
Yeah. If you look at say $100 pair of Nikes, there's about $1 worth of labor in terms of paying. I mean, it's worth more than that, but that's what they're paid. The Nike workers in Vietnam, for example, we just have a report that came out last year where when the first Nike campaign hit them with a lot of criticism, they made all these promises. Mm-hmm. So we took all these promises and we went out, we hired researchers and then we went out and we interviewed workers in these factories in different countries saying, you know, what about this? What about the toxic glues? What about the work hours? What about the age of the workers? What about the pay? And showed they lied on all of these things. It's a whole book. It's about a 120-page book that we have that shows they lied. And this is why people can't trust these companies. You can only trust them to make as much money as they possibly can, make as much profits as they can, pay their executives huge salaries. The guy, Philip Knight, who's the head of Nike, is worth about $6 billion. What can you do with that money? The only thing you can do with that money is control other human beings. They could double the wages of their workers, and it would add like $1 to a $100 pair of shoes.
He makes on in one H yeah. in 1 hour.
In 1 hour, what a worker makes in a year.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, is that right? Because we look back now on things like slavery, and everybody says, oh, that was wrong. Well, right now, there's slave conditions going on in a lot of places that are producing things that Americans use on a day-to-day basis. We just started a fair trade chocolate campaign. In West Africa, in Ghana and the Ivory Coast, there is actual slavery going on the cocoa plantations where the workers don't get paid anything. They're dragooned, they're young men that are actually physically grabbed, stuck on these plantations, and then they're forcibly kept on there. Now, people are walking around, oh, yeah, Valentine's Day, eating chocolate, and not realizing there's slave labor in that. Now, if we can look back 50 years and say, oh, what the Nazis did in the Holocaust, that was terrible, how are we going to be judged 30 or 40 years from now when people look back and say, you people didn't know? Why didn't you know? Why didn't you inform yourself? So what we're doing is taking the excuses away. We're putting the information out there on our website, globalexchange.org, and saying to people, look, there's a very easy thing to do. You go to See's Candy. Yeah, it's right there on the T-shirt. You go to See's Candy, and you say, look, you're profiting, your company is profiting from these slave labor conditions. It means they're getting the cocoa really cheap. their defense is just like Nike and these sweatshop companies was at first. They would say, well, we don't own those factories. And the chocolate companies say, we don't own those plantations. Yeah, but you profit from getting the stuff at a super low price because of the low wages that are paid or the no wages that are paid. So we, the consumer citizens here in the U.S., have to hold their feet to the fire and say, no, you're not going to get away with this.
And we get S-C-R-E screwed to B-E because we P-A we pay 200% more than it costs
sure.
to produce
That's
it.
Where these huge corporate profits come from, right? Yes. Look at the way in which, during the California energy crisis, in a period where you had an 800 to 1,000% increase in what we paid for electricity, our use of electricity only went up 4%. It wasn't the consumers that were at fault. Like, they kept saying, oh, it's you consumers, or it's the environmentalists for blocking the nuclear power plants. No, it was because these companies like Enron were just, they pushed for deregulation first in the government. They got the deregulation. They raised the prices to whatever they felt they could get away with. They screwed us out of tens of billions of dollars. As soon as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission instituted price caps, the California energy crisis stopped on that day. It was June 20-something of 2001. As soon as they implemented those price caps, the whole thing ends. So we've got to re-regulate these industries.
Why don't people N-O notice that?
Well, you know, Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. Malcolm X said the examined life is painful. It's painful to confront the truth, to think that, ooh, I might be wearing clothing or eating food that was produced through the exploitation of other people, the destruction of nature. Yeah, but that's a fact of life in today's current global economy. And you're either going to put your head in the sand or you get involved in changing it. John Madden, the football commentator, has a good maxim. He says there's three kinds of people in the world. The kind of people who make things happen, the kind of people who stand on the sidelines watching other people make things happen, and the kind of people who don't know what's happening. So you got to decide, which of those three do you want to be? For me, it's easy. I know which one I want to be. It's not a sideline spectator sport.
And it is for no reason. R reason. E X except for P R O profit. That profit. This there are T E C technologies O U out there.
Sure. You look at wind energy, for example. The Bush administration, oil guys in the White House, they come up with an energy plan that says, oh, no, we stick to burning fossil fuels, which is destroying our environment, causing global warming, buildup of greenhouse gases, etc. And they say, oh, conservation and alternatives, yeah, that's nice if you want to do that as an individual, but not as a policy. Well, in fact, if you look at the price structure of wind energy is now competitive with these other forms of energy. Countries like Denmark, a lot of our windmills here in California were manufactured in Denmark. This is a huge growth industry. Wind energy sales in the United States alone last year jumped 60%. This is a huge growth industry. If the federal government wanted to encourage that and put subsidies in that, the scientists tell us three states, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Texas, could provide the electricity. Just the wind energy could provide the electricity needed for the whole country.
But,
so the potential is huge.
But W I and wind is not profitable, is H A hard to M O monopolize.
That's it. See, now watch. What's going to happen is when the big oil companies, Exxon Mobil, Chevron, etc., as they start to own more and more of the solar and wind energy companies, then we'll start to get it. So ultimately, this stuff is not about a technical fix. We always get people calling us at Global Exchange saying, amaranth, soy, solar power, you know, the snake oil, you know, as if there's something we can rub on our head or put in our shoes and that's going to fix everything. It's political struggle is going to fix this. And the political struggle has to be aimed at separating corporations and the state. We established separation of church and state, and now we need separation of corporations and the state. They've taken over our government.
Get R I rid of corporations?
No institution. It's a simple principle. When they established this country, this principle of separation of corporation and the state of church and state was a simple idea. No one institution in society should dominate government. Government is supposed to be a tool of all the people and represent all the people. So why should corporations be able to dominate the government with this money that they get through profit-making globally by exploiting workers in countries where people don't have freedom to form a trade union or freedom to speak out? Notice how these guys, it's so hypocritical. You go back 10, 15 years, they were all anti-communism. Now Bush is over there sucking up to the Chinese Communist Party. Oh, it's okay. Yeah, because Hewlett-Packard and Intel and all these U.S. companies are in China producing at very low wages, very low environmental regulations, and bringing the stuff back here. The United States imports more computer equipment and electronics from China than China buys from the United States because all these U.S. companies shut down their factories here, move to China to produce it there, and bring it back here.
But, no, the S-H-E, the shell game. The shell game.
Sure. You can't allow people, if the public, if just I could do a brain dump of the stuff that I've learned from studying global economics into the American public, people would be out in the street. There'd be a rebellion. It's that they don't know. And I defy you, go through the 80 channels of TV or whatever it is, and you'll maybe find one or two that occasionally have something critical of corporate power. It's just not on.
Lover. Lover has a lot of stuff that's critical of corporate power.
Right.
We are S P O spoiled. Right. Well, I mean, we started Lover 3 years ago, and then the more and more we listened to Lover, the less we became able to watch TV.
But think about the average person out there. Right. I was just in North Carolina, in Elon, North Carolina, giving a talk at the university there. And you go around on the streets and in the shopping malls and stuff, and you just talk to regular people about what their concerns are and, you know, what their analysis is. And you see that people have just been so propagandized. But think, Nike, just Nike alone, if you gave our movement, the global justice movement, not just Global Exchange, but all the groups, if you gave us just Nike's advertising budget for 1 year, it's $1 billion, we'd kick ass. Because they are putting so much money into this misdirection of the public mind. And that's the bullseye issue, is the public mind. If we reach the public mind with a life values message against the money values message, we win. If we don't reach the public mind, we lose. That's really what it's about, is reaching the public mind and mobilizing people.
That is why they are S scared of us.
Sure. Yeah. It's why they have to mobilize the public airwaves. The public airwaves, radio and TV, belongs to us. We, the people, own it. Our government, our quote-unquote government, gives it to these media corporations, and they use it in a way that most people don't understand. Most people think that we're the consumers, we're doing the buying, and what's being sold is the tires and the toothpaste and the ads. That's not the way it is. We are the product. that's being sold to the corporate advertisers. It's why the cost of Super Bowl advertising goes way up, because the company, the media corporation, is delivering millions more minds to the corporate advertisers than can charge more. So, in fact, it's a form of slavery. We're being marketed and sold to these corporate advertisers. They don't care about our welfare, whether we're good people or civilized. They care about selling stuff and making money. And that's it. And whether it's cars or whatever, they're just interested in increasing their profits. That's what drives the system.
One. P. R. O. Problem. Is. R. A. Radical. J. No, radical. G. Groups. B. U. By. In. To. The. M. O. Money. M. The money. Money. M. A. S. S. Mass. Oh, like thinking that they have to reach a lot of people, and it's not worth it if you're not going to reach a lot of people.
One of the big problems in the movement that's now being dealt with and being solved, not completely, not quickly, but it's gradually being solved, is groups in the past on the left in the progressive movement would fight each other for funding, fight each other ideologically. We have the correct line. You don't have the correct line. That's starting to go by the wayside. If you look at these big mass mobilizations like happen in Seattle and Washington at the IMF, World Bank, etc., it's people realizing, okay, I might have my analysis and I might have my particular issue and I might have my way of approaching that. Maybe I'm into lobbying and you're into big demonstrations and somebody else is into writing letters to Congress, whatever. We come together, we subordinate our egos, we subordinate our particular perspective into the bouquet, into this larger biodiversity of a movement. That's what's going to... It's like fingers in a fist. Each finger has its own specific function. Thumb might be better for hitchhiking than a pinky, but it's when they work together that you either get the power of the fist or the beauty of a piano playing or whatever. And that consciousness now is starting to spread throughout the movement. Let's get over the sectarianism and let's work together. Let's come together and build a movement.
In that they... See, oh, come to us. We've had groups come to us to find out how to do an internet station because they want to do that. And so we tell them you can do it real cheap and we tell them how to do it.
Yeah.
And what's happened in a couple of situations is that they think that that's too rinky-dink. That they want to get like thousands and thousands of dollars and do it kind of bigger.
Yeah, if they can do it, that's great.
But so and then what happens
like
is they don't do it at all,
yeah,
you
right,
know?
Right.
And so if we always say, you know, just do it at this level and then maybe you'll be able to go to a higher,
well,
bigger level.
Well, it's like global
level.
Exchange. People look at us. We got 42 staff people. They say, wow, how'd you get to that size? Well, it took 13 years. Gradually, slowly build, and
yes.
You add on pieces
yes.
that can support themselves. The tours support themselves. The two stores we have support themselves. My books bring in royalties, not to me, but into the organization. When I get fees for speaking, that goes into the organization. Reggae in the park, we do events. And you get different streams of revenue, then you're not dependent on any one source.
Me, that's what we do too.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a basic principle organization that I think people should get hip to, and that is the more diverse the sources of funding, the more stability you have. It's like a centipede. It has 100 legs. You break one leg, no big deal.
Right.
If you're a lot of these NGOs are dependent on one or two foundations for the bulk of their money. If that foundation changes their direction, you're screwed. You go into a fiscal crisis.
Right.
So if you diversify your funding base, plus I think there's a consciousness. If everybody in the organization has the attitude of, I have a responsibility, I have a fiscal responsibility to the organization. One, to minimize expenditures, don't waste paper, you know, that kind of thing. Don't talk on the phone more than is necessary. And two, to maximize revenue coming in, then the organization will be stable. if people have this attitude of like, okay, you're the fundraiser, you raise the money, and I'll spend it, you've set up now a ghettoization of the people who raise the money, and that's not healthy.
And don't G-F-O focus on getting how many people you're reaching. That's the other thing we find, that people get kind of obsessed that they're not reaching enough people.
Well, there's different ways to reach people, too. For example, I do a lot of radio. Now, radio is great because you can be laying in bed at home doing a phone interview and reach thousands of people in a Detroit commute radio station early in the morning or something like that. That's great. But it's a thin hit because people are cooking, they're chopping up carrots, they're driving in their car, they might be at work. It's not the same as an hour lecture where you've got them in one room to hit them with your message solid for an hour, or having them read your book.
Or,
you know, there's different ways of reaching people.
Or a two-hour conversation like this.
Exactly, where you can get into stuff in detail. I do some radio shows where I'll say to the announcer, I'll say, well, what's your average sound bite? And some of these commercial stations, they'll say, try and keep your answers to 30 or 40 seconds.
Wow.
Well, what are you going to say in terms of explaining the global economy in 30 or 40 seconds? And then you just about get some momentum going, and it's a commercial. I got on one of these Fox News talk shows, Hannity and Combs, where it's a fake liberal, he's really a right-winger, and then a Nazi, a fascist, you know, and that's their spectrum. So I'm in a studio out here in San Francisco, and you got these bright lights in your face. It's so bright you can't even see the camera. And you got a little speaker in your ear where they're interrupting you before you finish your sentence, going, like this. And so my backstage mind, my New Jersey street kid mind, is saying, hey, listen, moron, if you were here face-to-face with me, you would not be talking this way to me. You'd be respectful, and we'd have a conversation. And you'd wait for me to finish, and then you would start. But my front stage mind has to say, no, 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 you can't go there. You got to be talking about, well, you know, the terrorists who did September 11th, we want to get them, but we want to get them smart. We don't want to get them stupid and kill innocent people. And these guys, you realize, they're not into debate. They're not into discourse. They've got control of the microphone, and they're just going to trash you if you disagree with them. Well, that shows they've lost. They can't stand up to a fair debate.
Yes. Yeah. But, and, I, R, E, C, E, I recently, S, saw, how, M, A, how many people, the statistics about how many viewers like CNN actually has, and it wasn't that many.
It's not that big.
No.
They define the public discourse, but they're not really reaching that many people.
I, T, H, thought, thought, L, lover, reached A, F, E, R, no, F, R, a fraction. You had thought before you saw that of, before you saw those stats, you thought that lever reached just a small fraction of the people.
Yeah.
I, of A, P, a fraction of a percentage.
Yeah.
But we reach 7%. It was something like that we had figured. 7% of the amount of people that CNN reach.
It's not just the numerical quantity. Yeah. It's the quality. Right. I think Chomsky has a great saying where he says the dominant ideology in the United States in the public mind is a mile wide and an inch thick. It's really thin. When you talk to people and you say, the free market, that's supposedly the dominant ideology. Business Week did a survey, an opinion poll, and they asked people, you know, what do you think is the best kind of economy? When they described a free market economy, only 4% of the people they interviewed agreed with that. Most people, the overwhelming majority, 72% said corporations have too much power, that there should be strict environmental regulations. People said they were willing to spend more money on a product if they knew it wasn't produced in sweatshop conditions. That's what's out there right under the surface, and that's why they have to do so much spending on all this propaganda to say, oh, no, no, everything's fine, the market, leave it to the market, get the government out of the way, because most people don't buy it.
Al, you, lover, don't see, oh, cost. How much it costs to do this? Is that what you mean? It's like $300 or so a month for, you know, and then we have to pay like ASCAP and BMI, but like $300 a month.
But now think, a very similar thing is going on in the movement, in these mass mobilizations. I say to these World Bank guys, give us the same amount of money that you spend on your big meetings. Give us that money for mobilizing our protests. We'll shut you down for good.
They
spend a fraction of what they spend.
Can, yes. They cannot C-O-M-P compete with us.
Yeah,
they
we're much more efficient. Yeah. See, and this is what I keep saying to people. When people say, oh, Kevin, you know, world hunger, how could you solve that? I say, well, wait, let's look at the numbers. The United Nations Children Fund estimates that it would take about $30 billion a year to eliminate malnutrition and starvation among children. Okay, $30 billion, that sounds like a lot of money. That's what the U.S. Pentagon spends each year on maintaining the nuclear weapons stockpile to defend us against who? The Soviet Union isn't existing anymore. You know, this is really not a huge amount of money when you look at shifting what we currently spend on stupidity. There's currently $800 billion a year spent on military hardware that if you took that money, if we shut down all the national militaries, and you got to shut them all down at the same time. You can't do one at a time because they're all justifying their existence saying, we're protecting you from those others. So you say, okay, let's have a global campaign. We shut down all the militaries, $800 billion. You put that into healthcare and education and food and vaccines and stuff. All sorts of global problems get dealt with really quick. There is enough money out there.
But no P R profit for anybody.
Well, that's why we have to build a big movement. Because, and see, I think if you look at it in these terms, if you put enough people out in the street, outside a building where policies are being made, you can influence any policy in the world. The Seattle protests at the end of 99, that was the only time ever in history where a World Trade Ministers conference got together and ended up in collapse. They didn't even issue a final communique, no final press conference, nothing. It collapsed because of our unity on the outside created infighting on the inside, and it fell apart. It disintegrated. And that should be our model. Unite friends, divide adversaries. That's what all politics is about anyway. At its core. So we can do it if we mobilize enough people. But we got to go out and reach people, educate them, make the movement attractive and seductive, and bring in more people.
F. U. N. Funny. Before. 9-91-911. They were in on the R U on the run.
Yeah. If you go back, we had had a meeting in May of last year, a little over a year ago, May of 2001, in the AFL-CIO headquarters. And it was the AFL-CIO trade union leadership and everything, the Naderite left, all the way over into the anarchist community. And for 3 days, we struggled around these global economic issues. And we came up, because there had been a fracture from the Gore-Nader split, right, where the trade unions were largely backing Gore, and we were all backing Nader, or at least most of us. And we mended that split, and we came away from those 3 days of meetings. And, you know, it got testy at times, but we hung in there and used our communication skills. And we got unity on three things: no fast track for Bush on trade negotiating authority, cancel the debt, no more structural adjustment, protest the World Bank and the IMF, and no new round of trade talks for the World Trade Organization. That's huge. So when September 11th happened, we were ready to shut down the World Bank IMF meetings at the end of September. We were going to have about 100,000 people out there, including trade unionists ready to do civil disobedience. It was going to be big. And September 11th came along, and look at the way the people in power, Bush in particular, opportunistically jumped on it. It was like the Reichstag fire in Germany. Oh, everybody shut up now. You protesters are siding with the terrorists. There's more similarity between Bush and bin Laden than between the protest movement and these terrorists. You know, I always say to people, look, there's an oil millionaire who believes it's okay to kill innocent people because God is on his side. Is that Bush or is that bin Laden? These guys come out of the same damn mold. It's money values, God is on my side.
They were even in business together.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah. Bush's father has had business dealings with the bin Laden family, the Carlyle group that Bush's father is part of. They've been dealing with these guys making money. Cheney's company that he was head of was making money doing business with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Then they come out to the American people and say, oh, Saddam Hussein, terrible guy. We got to get him. Under the Reagan administration from 1980 to 1988, the largest recipient of U.S. food aid credits was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. People say, well, food aid credits? What? They're not a poor country. They weren't starving back then. They are now because of the U.S. sanctions. There was a war that was fomented by the U.S. government between Iran and Iraq. Because you got to remember, Iran was run by the Shah, who the U.S., the CIA, put into power in 1953. They give the Shah, means king, Shahan Shah, king of kings, actually. He rules for like 25 years. U.S. government, Republicans, Democrats, they give him all these weapons, everything except nuclear weapons. Then in the late 70s, he gets overthrown by Ayatollah Khomeini, who says the U.S. is the devil. Uh-oh. Now you got a problem. You got a government that's got all these U.S. weapons and a guy who says the U.S. is the devil. What are you going to do? Well, the only neighboring country that could break the legs of Iran was Iraq. So the U.S. went to Iraq and said, look, we'll help you kick ass on Iran. And there was all sorts of military aid and food aid credits and all this different stuff to help Saddam Hussein smash the Iranian economy. Then once that's done by 1988, then they start thinking, okay, now how do we deal with Iraq? And they purposely set about getting Iraq, stupid Saddam Hussein, to invade Kuwait. They set him up for it. The Kuwaitis were slant drilling with Texas technology, slant drilling into oil reserves that are under Iraqi territory. Kuwait was created as a piece, the British did it. It was a piece of Iraq that the British broke away as a way to block their access to the sea. So they know that this guy is stupid and he's a power monger, etc. They lure him into invading Kuwait, and then it's, oh, hey, this guy's aggressive. Well, wait a minute. When the Israelis invaded Jordan and Egypt and took land away from Syria and invaded Lebanon, the United States government didn't say, oh, we got to attack Israel to put them back in their cage and not have them invade. So you see this double standard that's out there. And really, for that region, it's all about oil. If the major export of the Middle East were broccoli, none of this stuff would be happening. It's about oil and the fact that this country's economy is addicted to oil. And if you go back and look at the history, at the same time that the U.S. government and the British government were imposing a monarchy in Saudi Arabia, the House of Al Saud, it's the only country named after a family. It's like United States of Rockefeller or something. They put in power this monarchy. No constitution. Can women vote? Women can't drive cars, okay? Not at all democratic, very anti-democratic, very right-wing ideology, very conservative. At the same time they're doing that in the 30s and 40s, what's happening in the United States? In the United States, General Motors and a whole bunch of other automobile-related companies, rubber, glass, tire, petroleum, etc., they form a consortium. They go around the United States and they buy up about 36 mass transit systems, light rail vehicle systems like the J Church in San Francisco.
H-E-R-E here in B-E in Berkeley.
Los Angeles had the largest mass transit system in the world. It was a light rail vehicle system. And this consortium systematically destroyed those systems, replaced them with cars and highways running on internal combustion engines, burning petroleum. They were taken to court. They were proven guilty. They were convicted of a criminal conspiracy to destroy U.S. mass transit systems. They were fined $5,000. Ooh. So you see the double standard. The rich, oh, don't do it again. The poor, shoot that kid in the back. He just robbed a liquor store. Three strikes, you're out. You stole a pizza. You stole a bicycle. Tough luck. If we had three strikes, you're out for corporate crime, and we said, let's say we said three felonies for a corporation, no more government contracts. Every major Pentagon contractor would be crossed off the list, just like that, because they've already done more than three felonies.
Five million? No. 500,000
Yeah. Look at the asthma rates.
Tobacco. 3,000
Now, this is not to say, I don't want anybody to think that I'm not appalled by what the people who did September 11th did. It's wrong. It can't be justified. No violence against innocent people can be justified. That same day that 3,000 or 4,000 people were killed in the United States, there were between 30,000 and 40,000 children who died from the effects of hunger and hunger-related diseases that are totally curable. There's plenty of food in the world. We have millions of children dying each year from gastroenteritis, diarrhea. It comes from bad water. Billions of people in the world are drinking bad water that's killing them and killing their children. The cure, quote unquote, is clean water with a little bit of sugar and salt in it. We're talking pennies. There's kids dying from measles. We wouldn't allow our kids to die from measles because the vaccine is like a few cents. So when you have children dying for lack of a few cents, you got to say something's wrong. Right now in Africa, each year, there are more children dying from AIDS than died in Nazi Germany during the entire German Holocaust against the Jews and gypsies and homosexuals. And yet Americans are there, rah, rah, our military in Afghanistan flying Apache and, attack helicopters that are named Black Hawk helicopters, named after the Native American groups who we did genocide against. If the German military named their attack helicopters the Jew and the Gypsy and the Homo, what would we think? We'd think, God, they're sick. And most Americans don't even think about this. It doesn't even enter their consciousness. So we have this huge project in front of us. Can we get people to wake up and pay attention to what the hell is going on? Because we will get judged. History will judge us. And I'm afraid it's going to judge us negatively if we don't get our act together soon.
D-U-N-N-D-U-N, dumb, F-E-L-T, felt, dumb felt, S-A, said, K, I, killing, S, A, F, A, F, G, African, no, killing, A, F, G, A,
Afghans,
on, O, U, our, S, I, on our side, is, A, C, accident, ACC.
Collateral damage, yeah. Yeah, well, think about this. Osama bin Laden says it's okay to kill these Americans because they're infidels, non-believers. The Pentagon says it's okay for us to kill innocent civilians in Afghanistan because they're collateral damage. There's no justification for killing innocent people. We started a program at Global Exchange, a victims fund, a fund for the victims of U.S. bombing in Afghanistan, little edgy in-your-face humanitarianism. We got on CNN, the Today Show, Fox, all this kind of stuff. Our website got up to 95,000 hits a day from penetrating the corporate media. Because people understand it's wrong to hurt innocent people. If somebody in my neighborhood commits a crime and you come in and burn down the whole neighborhood, everybody knows that's wrong. So my wife and three other staffers from Global Exchange, we go over, and my older daughter went too with a video camera, and they taped interviews with people like, and I'll just give you one taste, 12-year-old girl, the U.S. bomb hit their house, killed the mother, the father went crazy. This 12-year-old girl is now responsible for raising five younger brothers and sisters. I have an 11-and-a-half-year-old girl. A 12-year-old girl is not going to raise five younger kids. That's just not going to happen, at least not in the way children should be raised. There's no way that 12-year-old girl is going to raise enough money. Is the U.S. government going to go in and make it right for all these victims, family members of people who were killed and had their homes and lives destroyed? That's up to us as citizens. We got to push this.
N, E, never, did, before.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're talking about is, okay, we got this victims fund for the victims of U.S. bombing in Afghanistan. What about the victims of U.S. war in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras? There's famine going on right now in Central America, in a part of the world that has good soil, good rain, talented people, and a lot of sunshine. There shouldn't be any famine. There shouldn't even be any hunger. But it's an exporter of calories. They're growing coffee, tea, cocoa, cotton, beef for Wendy's and McDonald's. They're growing stuff for us instead of for their own people. And that's basic to the global economy.
Yes. I. H. A. Had. We've had two. We had the people that started the company Planet Organics, which is like delivers organic food. And then we had a woman that started Full Belly Farm, who does community-supported agriculture.
One of the things that I'm working on right now at Global Exchange is a green economy project, and we're going to do a green economy festival. Get the organic, the solar, the wind energy, the community-supported agriculture, the environmental groups. Get everybody together in a huge place in the concourse where KPFA does their crafts fair. And get people together and say, look, we're an alternative system. Whether you're talking about energy or transport or health care or housing or food, there is an alternative way to do it that's respectful of human rights and respectful of Mother Nature. We can do it a different way.
They don't. Q. Quite get. Well, in both cases, it seemed like they didn't quite get that it wasn't okay to have people producing stuff outside of our country to send to our country.
Well, it's not necessary. I mean, do you really need grapes out of season Chile?
Right,
you know, you don't really need them.
Right, but that was like we were frustrated because they didn't seem to get. They were thinking like, well, their customers, you know, need some strawberries in the winter.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing if you grow them in a hothouse, but if you're flying them in from Chile, that's something else again.
They don't get that M means the people that live where these farms are being.
This is why we do the reality tours. If you take people down to Central America and you take people out to two different kinds of coffee growing farms, one is a coffee plantation that was done by corporations. About 30 years ago, they re-engineered the coffee bean to survive outside of shade trees, out in the open sun. The shade trees, though, historically provided the biodiversity that kept down the pest infestations. When you go to open sun coffee, you got to throw a lot of chemicals on it to kill the bugs and diseases, whatever. Poisons the soil, poisons the water, poisons the workers. You'll see kids bathing in a 50-gallon drum that used to hold chemicals. That drum wasn't cleaned out and washed out. The instructions are in English, so they can't even read it. Now you go, then you take people over to a fair trade coffee co-op that's shade tree production, organic production. The farmers are getting paid $1.26 a pound for their beans. The free market price is about 45 cents, and the farmers aren't even getting that. They're getting maybe 25 or 30 cents. The 45 cents is going to the guy with the truck, the coyote, who can go out and get it from them, right? And the farmers don't own a truck, so they don't have that power to take it to market. The fair trade co-ops, on the other hand, there's 550,000 small farmers grouped into the fair trade movement, with groups like Global Exchange, Transfer USA in Oakland, here in the global north, that are pressuring the coffee companies to sell the fair trade stuff, and it cuts into their profits because they got to pay more for it, and they have to pay 10 cents a pound for the license that says fair trade certified. But it's us using our political muscle and our organizing educational skills, mobilize customers, put pressure on the company, say, you're going to spend this extra money, and we'll guarantee it gets to the producers, and we can go to your customers and say, hey, if it means an extra penny or two per cup in that $1.50 cup of coffee, and we guarantee you it gets to the poor farmer, will you pay that extra penny or two? Most customers are going to say yes. And that's the Achilles heel of these companies. We can educate and mobilize their customers.
A no-brainer. That's a no-brainer.
That's right. And that's what we say to these companies when we meet with them. We say, look, there's two ways we can do this. We can do it the nasty conflict way, where we do demonstrations out in front of your place and drive down your profits and make you look bad. And then in a year or two, when you go along with us and do what we want to anyway, you're going to look like you just did it because of the pressure. Or you can get out in front of the curve right now and look real good and do the right thing, do the smart thing. And if you get enough people inside that company to see that light bulb and go, yeah, that makes sense. What we do is when we do a corporate campaign, we buy stock in the company, so that we can go into the shareholders meeting. We can do a demonstration outside, but we can also go into the shareholders meeting. And we get up and we say, look, do you want to lose money? Do you want the value of your stock going down? Do you want to lose profits like Nike and the Gap? The Gap right now, we've had a campaign for a couple of years and a big lawsuit against them because of their sweatshop conditions. Just yesterday in the paper shows their profits and revenues are tanking. Now, we can't prove that we made that happen, but they can't prove that we didn't make it happen.
They always W-O-R work in the dark. B-E behind D doors.
Yeah, sure. The whole system is based on secrecy because the structure of the corporation is a hierarchy. It's not internally democratic, and its impact out there in the world is not democratic. Just like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, World Trade Organization, they're hierarchies. It's like a military. The person at the top can fire people down here, you know, totally get away with it. It's not a democratic process, and their relationship to our governments is one of domination by money values. So it's neither internally democratic, and it's not democratic in terms of its relations with government. So, of course, it has to operate in secret. The World Bank and the IMF, which we pay for with our tax money, documents are secret. When they do these negotiations around debt agreements, they only make public the documents after the agreement is signed. So the people in Argentina or whatever the debtor country is, they can't intervene in the process because you don't know what the negotiations are.
Like B. R, BTV, like BTV, the same thing, the cable access channel. They're doing this. They do the same thing where they do it when nobody knows
behind
about it.
Behind closed doors, yeah. Sure. Well, that's why you'll see these organizations, they'll schedule meetings on weird days. Look, the fact that we have elections on a Tuesday, how about having elections on a holiday or a weekend? Make it a day off. People have to go to work. So, of course, a lot of people don't vote. I'm not making excuses here, but of course, a certain percentage of people, they get up in the morning, they got to rush to work. At the end of the day, they're tired from work. I'm too tired to go vote. And then you get half the population not voting, even in presidential elections. And in local elections, you get maybe 70 or 80% don't vote. So what's all this stuff about America as a democracy when most people are sort of asleep at the switch? They're not even participating in the process.
But you, if you S-H-O-I-M, S-H-I-N, shine a light on them.
Well, they don't like that. Of course, right. It's like a rat. You know, rats don't like light right. shining on them, too. Right. But that's, I think that's the role of educators and activists, is to open things up and say, wait a minute, let's look at what's really going on here. Let's not live in Never Never Land and believe what feels comfortable to believe. Let's look at the truth. The truth will set us free. But the truth is painful. The truth is scary. You know, you can really get freaked out by looking at the truth. When I started traveling in Africa and seeing children die right in front of my face, right in my arms, because of things like calorie deficiency, protein deficiency, measles, things that shouldn't even occur, that does something to you. And the first stage is to just freak out and cry. But then after you work through that, you get really angry and you say, okay, if I'm going to channel this rage into something productive other than just going nuts, I have to find out what's the source of this. There's a story about two women are walking along a river and they see a kid drowning. And a woman dives in, saves the kid. The kid's okay. They return the kid to their family. They walk a little further. There's another kid drowning. Same woman swims out, saves the kid. Kid's okay. They return to the family. They walk a little further. Third kid's drowning. Woman swims out there. Same woman. As she's coming back with the kid, the other woman takes off running along the bank. And the one in the water says, where are you going? And she says, I'm going to get the bastard who's throwing these kids in the water. If you don't get at the source of the problem, you end up getting compassion fatigue. And in fact, in the aid industry, this is a term, compassion fatigue, because they're constantly intervening to feed starving people without raising the question, wait, in a world of abundant food, why should there even be one hungry person? There's no reason for it. There's no defensible reason for it.
I and E A each was each and every P R E R each and every person can do something.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what it requires. It requires acting. You think about if we're walking down the street and there's a house on fire and you know, you say to me, Kevin, look, you know, there's a kid in an upstairs window screaming for help. That house is on fire. And I say to you, well, you know, I don't really know much about fire. I'm going to go to the library and get a book about combustion. You're going to assume I'm morally bankrupt and you're going to be right. And the thing to do is to call for help, call 911, break down the door to do something. Well, the planet is on fire in that sense, and the children are screaming at that window on a global level. And that's why the people in power keep doing this to us, saying, oh, no, no, it's okay. Don't worry about that. Leave it to the experts. We'll take care of it. While the environmental crisis gets worse, every biological system is in a state of collapse, and the inequality crisis gets worse. And then that means that in order to ignore that, the moral, spiritual crisis gets worse because people, instead of dealing with it and paying attention to what's really going on, they're doing this. They're doing the misdirection and saying, well, it's not really that bad. Well, it's the fault of the poor. They have too many kids. Blame the victim. There's a million different excuses. But that stuff will be judged historically as a cop-out because that's what it is. It's a cop-out. So our job is to make it easier for people to take that first step. That's why at Global Exchange we do fair trade coffee. It's very easy to go in a store and instead of buying plantation coffee that destroys the environment and hurts people, you buy fair trade coffee that's a different system. Okay, that's the first step. Or our stores. We get people who come in our stores and they'll see like a pencil box that was made in Haiti. And it's nice, it's colorful, it's cute. And then you can say, well, do you know about Haiti? Do you know what's going on there?
Right there.
Yeah, the metalwork. They do great metalwork. And you can say, okay, this is the first step. You did the easy step. Now would you like a little information about what's going on in the world? And if you can get them to take step after step, The longest journey begins with that first step. So we're trying to reach out. We produce stuff for radicals, but we're mainly focused on reaching mainstream audiences with that first step. Don't you want to understand the world and get involved in changing it?
I wrote A L E a letter to the editor. This was about the BTV thing. Yeah. That was all it took to start everything changing. He just sat down one afternoon, wrote this letter, just like looked up all the addresses to the letters of the editor. I mean, it took us like
a
few hours.
And sometimes you don't know the impact you're having. I was just down in Porto Alegre.
Yeah.
There were 50,000 people came to Porto Alegre. And I'm friends, actually, one of the organizers is a global exchange person who's based in Brazil. And I said to her, Maísa, you know, you have to be incredibly happy about what you've done here, because there's no way you can even predict all the cross-pollination that's going to go on, because you've got grassroots activists from 130 countries, from the global north, the global south, women's activists, environmental activists, people struggling on water, against the World Bank, all these different issues. They come together, they start strategizing. There's all sorts of chemistry that comes out of that, and new movements get started. We started a coalition on Enron to make sure that something happens in terms of a structural critique, because Congress is going to do this, oh, it's just one bad company, a few bad individuals, sweep it under the rug kind of thing. And we want to make sure that it gets out there to the public. Like, no, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is a structural systemic problem. So all sorts of stuff comes out of that. And you might not know. I've had times where I've done a radio show that I thought, oh, probably nobody's listening. And then you get a letter from a woman out in Montana who she says, I'm out here with three kids on my own, struggling to keep this farm going. And I heard you on the radio, and it was like I felt part of a global movement, and it gave me
Why?
Hope. You know,
E years L later. That happens to us all the time. Yeah. Years later, somebody will call us or email us or something and say, you know, coming to that event you did changed the course of my life.
And even if somebody, let's say God came down and told me, none of this stuff you're doing is going to, I'd still want to do it.
Right.
Because
right.
it's the right thing to do,
right.
as opposed to copping out or being part of the problem. We used to say right. in the 60s, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. There's no middle, sideline, etc. You got to get involved in it. And to not choose is to choose. You're making
yes.
a choice when you say, oh, I'm not going to get involved. That's a choice.
Like that L A B labor S O N song R E no W H I which side
are you on?
Yeah.
Pick a side. Because if you think you don't have to pick a side, you're fooling yourself. And see, one of the problems with this country is there's so much affluence, there's so much stuff. I mean, you can almost live off the garbage. Some people do, not that it's a fun lifestyle. But you go to other countries, you go to really poor countries, people are struggling just to survive, just to get their kids to reach adulthood. The life expectancy in Afghanistan is about 40 years. That's just not right. The Soviet Union, I was just in Europe at a conference in Amsterdam, and a buddy of mine who lives in Moscow says that the average life expectancy of the average Russian male has declined over 10 years since capitalism came to Russia. So it's you've got some millionaires and you've got this elite class that's doing very well, smoking cigars, drinking champagne. But the bulk of the population has had the rug pulled out from under them. The safety net has been pulled away. And they actually now have a regular occurrence where the temperature drops in Moscow and people die out on the streets. And he says a lot of it, it's not just homelessness, it's drunkenness. It's people who are so despairing and hopeless that they go out, they get drunk, they fall asleep on the sidewalk, and they freeze overnight. That's a really serious crisis that everybody needs to get freaked out by and say, wait a minute, something's seriously wrong when people are just dying by the side of the road. If we read that happening in history 500 years ago, we'd say, oh, what barbarism. Well, that's happening now, right now, today. It's our responsibility to do something about it.
In SAF, San Francisco.
Oh, we've got homeless people right outside our office at 16th and Mission. People who are living out on the streets, strung out on drugs, sleeping on the streets, sleeping in doorways. Does the mayor ever walk through that neighborhood? The only time the mayor comes through that neighborhood, you know when he's coming through the neighborhood, because about 20 or 30 minutes before he comes, the street sweepers come through, the police come through to clear out the prostitutes and the drug dealers, and then Willie comes through with his entourage. And I think if you have a system set up where the people who make mass transportation policy never ride the bus, and the people who make energy policy don't pump their own gas, and the people who make housing policy live in mansions and gated communities, of course you're going to have screwed up policy. That makes sense. If you got somebody making mass transit policy, you don't pay. In San Francisco, they pay the guy who runs Muni about $140,000 a year and a car. They give him a car. Give him a pass. Have him ride his own bus.
Why?
So he knows what the conditions are.
A Y A I N Y ain't the J H B U S bus F free.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If mass transit were free and going across the bridge was $10 per car, you'd see people switch right away. But obviously the power of the auto industry has something to do with that. What you see in Washington is the transportation department is colonized by the auto industry. The Environmental Protection Agency gets colonized by the chemical companies, the big polluters. They understand that if there is government that can possibly be a tool of the people for regulating them, they have to get in there and control those agencies and make sure that they're defanged and that they can't be an effective instrument for we the people. And that's why we're pushing this separation of corporations and the state. Until we take government back for the people and that people have this consciousness. Notice what the right wing did. The neoliberal conservatives did a very brilliant thing. In all their propaganda, one of the themes that was suffused throughout all of the specific stuff was get government out of the way. Government's bad. Get government out of the way. Government is us. If government is bad, that's our fault, and it's our responsibility to fix it. So what we've got to do is do a counter message of say, no, wait a minute. We are the citizens. We are supposed to rule. Government is supposed to be our property. It's not supposed to be privatized and taken over by the corporations. It's supposed to be our tool to defend us against these powerful money types. And that consciousness should suffuse all of our work in the corporate accountability movement, the global economy movement, the environmental movement.
That is HJ. That is just the FI first step. We will not be S.A. safe until the C corporations are broken up.
Yeah. And that's, see, what's going on is you have a two-pronged movement going on. The corporate accountability movement, anti-corporate globalization movement, is doing the frontal assault on the corporation, saying, look at the damage they do to the environment. Look at the damage they do to human rights. That's the outside the castle, like this. Then there's the alternative economy movement that's coming around the other side, saying to people, look, not only is your boat on fire, but we're building an alternative boat here. And I think you got to do both. Screaming your boat's on fire, if you only do that, at a certain point, people are going to say, hey, I agree with you, Nike sucks. What shoes do I buy? If the movement had created a fair trade sneaker during the anti-Nike campaign, we could have sold tons of sneakers. We could have made a lot of money. So the movement now is developing enterprise skills and saying, look, it's not that money is evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. And that's actually out of the Bible, Timothy 6:10. So when you're dealing with your Christian friends, we use it at demonstrations outside the World Bank. The love of money is the root of all evil, with drummers, you know. And the bankers hear that. They read the Bible. They go, oh, yeah, that's out of the Bible. So we're building enterprise skills to say, we can create goods and services without exploiting people and without exploiting the environment, and the profits you make, because you got to make a surplus or you go out of business, you put it back into the movement. That's all. Simple. You don't make profits so that I can have 10 BMWs and a cocaine habit. That's not what it's supposed to be about. These guys that are worth billions of dollars, are they really happy? Yeah, they sleep on a good mattress, but are they really happy when there's a lot of people around the world who are miserable because of them? I don't think so.
I am P-U-S pushing maximum income. Frank likes the idea of maximum income.
One of the ideas that I've been pushing is we need, if you look at the development of any national economy, at a certain stage in the development of a national economy, you get a minimum wage for that economy. All the industrialized countries have it. And in fact, a lot of countries have much better than the U.S. Denmark, it's $14 an hour. $14 an hour, right? It'd be great here. But you got a living wage movement here, both living wage domestically and living wage for foreign workers. So what I say is, look, if we're going to have a global economy, let's have a global minimum wage. And you can figure out what that is. You can go into any economy, see what does it cost for a kilo of beans, a kilo of rice, what does it cost to live? So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that we had a $10,000 minimum wage. That's a floor underneath everybody. That sounds low, but for most people, that would be a huge increase. A lot of people are living on $200, $300 a year. But if we're going to have a global minimum wage, let's also have a global maximum wage. And let's say you set it at $10 million.
Right.
That's huge.
Right.
That allows all this movement, because they say, oh, I got to have incentive. Hey, if you need more than $10 million a year, you got a big drug habit, baby. So these guys would fight like hell. And I want to see them get up in public or get up in the well of Congress and say, oh, no, we can't restrict income to $10 million a year. The American people are going to say, what? What kind of drug are you taking? You know? So reason and rationality is on our side in this, and we need to use it and get out there and stick it up their nose.
Two. That is why the S-E-S-T-A-N standard of living will not drop like the like our kids' friends think.
Well, if you look at what's going on in the U.S., I'm actually working on a book that is mostly charts and graphs of the U.S. economy. You go back to the 1970s. It was Nixon that started implementing these free market policies. Let the corporations move the factories out of the country. Don't charge them taxes when they bring the products back in. This is why we have more computer equipment coming in from China than China buys from the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Because they started back in the 70s loosening the controls on capital. Let them go anywhere they want, do anything they want, and we get these free trade agreements, so-called, like NAFTA, now the World Trade Organization. And if you look at the data, and I have like probably about 40 or 50 charts and graphs, and what it shows is the average wages for the average worker go down. The relationship of the average worker's pay to the corporate CEO's pay keeps getting bigger and bigger disparity. The inequality among families between the richest 20% and the rest of the population gets more extreme. The inequality between whites and blacks does not improve over 40 years in terms of the average wealth. The ownership of business assets gets more and more concentrated. You do a pie chart. The little piece of the pie chart, it's what's owned by 90% of the businesses. And the big piece of the pie chart is what's owned by 10% of the businesses. And just all along the economy, you see the government going bankrupt. Our federal government now is $7 trillion with a T, $7 trillion in debt. The interest payments on that federal debt last year, 2001, was $400 billion. That's bigger than the Pentagon. Where's that money going? That's interest, not principal, interest paid to banks, insurance companies, corporations, and a lot of them are Japanese banks, British insurance companies, it's money leaving the United States. So these guys have gutted the U.S. economy. They've created more inequality. They've bankrupted our government. The balance of payments deficit is just going like this for like over 25 years now. We can't go on. The reason we've been allowed to get away with this by the rest of the world is because we're the biggest dog on the block. We're the biggest economy. And there's a lot of foreign investors who are willing to invest in U.S. Treasury bills, that is, U.S. government debt. But if the U.S. dollar starts to go down, and all currencies eventually go down, they don't all just stay up there forever. If the U.S. dollar starts to go down, all bets are off. This economy could unravel like a 1930s-style depression in a matter of weeks, and it would really be the caca hitting the fan. And unfortunately, I don't want people to wait for that kind of crisis for them to wake up. I would rather people look at the information now and say, look, we're headed at a brick wall at 80 miles an hour. The guys driving the car are talking about what CD to play. We should be hitting the brakes and turning the wheel. We're going to crash. It's just a question of how soon is it going to come? And can we prepare ourselves and change these policies? So we need to re-regulate the economy. We need to emphasize life values, worker rights, and the environment over money rights of the corporations. And we got to get them out of power. We need campaign finance reform, full public funding of campaigns. We need to end corporate lobbying and corporate welfare. All of that. We need a constitutional firewall. We need a constitutional amendment that says a corporation is not a human being. I want to see them get up in Congress and say, no, a corporation is a human being. You can't argue that. So we've got them by the short hairs if we get out there and do the organizing.
Have. The. C. R. C. E. O. CEOs. B. R. E. S. Responsible for what the corporation does.
Okay, there's two ways of looking at this. One is a structural analysis, and the other is an instrumental analysis. The structure analysis says, look, if I were the CEO of a corporation, I would be forced to maximize profits. Because if I don't, I'm going to lose my job. The board of directors is going to take me out. That is structural. It's built into the genetic code of the system. Maximize profits. The danger of that is that a 1,000-year-old redwood tree is not a gift of the creator or a gift of Mother Nature. It's $300,000 worth of lumber. A fish swimming has no value until you kill it and turn it into a marketable commodity. That's built into the system. The only thing in nature that has that same kind of drive, that kind of on switch with no off switch, is a malignant tumor, a metastasizing cancer cell. It grow, 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 grow. That's all it knows is growth. And that's what the capitalist economy does. Well, think what a cancer, a metastasizing tumor, does to its biological host, the body. It kills it. What is capitalism doing to the planet, the biological host? It's killing it. That's at the structural system level. Then there's the instrumental analysis that says, let's look at the individual behavior of these particular people. Who is Bush beholden to? Who are these corporate executives that are making these decisions? They could make different decisions. They could decide to speed up going away from internal combustion engines that burn fossil fuels, dead dinosaurs that's destroying our climate, to solar and hydrogen cells is what it's going to go for, is fuel cells, where it's run on hydrogen. The only exhaust that comes out of a fuel cell vehicle is water, is pure water. You can drink it right out of the exhaust. There are already buses in places like Greenland and Canada that are running on fuel cells. This technology exists now. It just needs the investment made in it. And that's where we got to hold these people responsible. They're making bad decisions.
They are T R E P we are reproducing? No. R-E-P-R-E-S repressing that technology.
Sure, yeah. You know, you can find cases throughout history. There was a lubricant. There was an engine lubricant that was invented decades ago that was a far superior lubricant than anything that was out there on the market. And literally, you know, like one can of it would have replaced four or five cans of the old stuff. But they held it off the market because they wanted to be able to sell all the old junk that they had before they brought this on the market. If you look at the way big corporations work, they don't compete anymore like in the old days when this ideology of, oh, competitiveness is going to cause them to come up with the best products and that causes advancement of civilization. What they do is a thing called price leadership. Instead of competing and saying, okay, I'm going to lower my price under him and I'll get more customers, they do this thing called price leadership where Ford will announce that they're raising their price a certain level. If General Motors and the others don't go along with it pretty soon, Ford will retract that increase. They do not compete in terms of price. They compete in terms of advertising and stuff like that. But they understood, particularly in these monopolized sectors, they understood a long time ago, hey, we don't want to cut each other's throats. We want to make as much money, bilk as much money out of the public as we can. So there's a collaboration. Now, technically, it's illegal. It's against antitrust legislation for them to formally sit down and say, okay, let's do this and to strategize. So they have to develop mechanisms like price leadership or another one of the things they did do, and Enron was doing this, it's a thing called transfer pricing. You've got a multinational corporation that's operating in 10 or 15 countries. You on your books, you manipulate your pricing within the company. You got a part coming from this country, a part coming from that country. You manipulate your pricing on your books, so you show a loss in countries like the U.S. that have a high tax rate, and you show your profits in the countries that have low taxes or no taxes. And in fact, that process of transfer pricing is so basic to these big transnational corporations. There's a whole journal. It costs thousands of years to subscribe to it. They sent me a sample copy because I subscribe to Business Week and stuff. They think I'm an executive. They send me this thing. It's a whole journal on how to manipulate international tax differences among countries so that you can pay no taxes. Enron, in the last 5 years, four of those 5 years, paid no taxes to the federal government. Excuse me, you're making billions of dollars. You're one of the biggest companies in the country, and you're not paying taxes. So what you find is multi-billion dollar companies, big transnational corporations, that pay less taxes than Joe Blow truck driver, not just less percentage-wise of their income, but less as an amount, as a quantity. It's unbelievable, but they get away with it. In fact, there's a good book called America, Who Really Pays the Taxes by Barlett and Steele, these two reporters who, it's actually a very interesting book. I never thought the IRS code would be interesting to read about. But these guys take it apart and they show there's two tax systems. There's one for the rich and there's one for the rest of us. And I had a friend once, years ago, who was a tax attorney. And she said the only millionaires who pay taxes are the ones who are too stupid to hire a good tax attorney. Because there's enough loopholes out there that you can get away without paying taxes. Whereas the average working class person, and in fact, the IRS for years had a conscious policy of auditing working class and middle class people more scrupulously than the rich, because they knew the rich would fight it out and had lawyers, whereas working class people are intimidated by the IRS and they'll pay up real quick. So you get a quicker return on your pressure. It's amazing. But it is a system, and it is understandable.
F-I-F-U. Funny. I have. B. I have been. T. Talking about. What. I call C the combine. No, the combine. Is that it? Right. Well, like back when I met Frank in 75, he was talking about this combine plot. And it was like the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ken Kesey book. He talks about how everybody's kind of wired. And so it's like when you like do something, you get this kind of shot. And so that's what keeps everybody in line.
Yeah.
And Frank was saying, well, that system exists and we're all kind of in that system. And, you know, people would look at him like, hello.
There's a great film that people don't know about called Harrison Bergeron, B-E-R-G-E-R-O-N, Harrison Bergeron. It's based on a Kurt Vonnegut short story. You won't find this film around because it's very subversive. And it's exactly this. It's set in the future, but it looks like the 1950s. And everybody's kind of happy in the soda shop and all. But everybody wears these electrodes on their head. And when somebody gets out of line, the secret government, everybody thinks there is no government, they can zap you and dumb you down.
Yes.
And nobody is supposed to be really smart. So it's this kid, Harrison Bergeron, and he's acing all his tests in school, and he's really smart and all. And they keep turning up the amplitude on his thing, and they can't dumb him down. So they say, okay, we're going to have to give you an operation. We're going to do a lobotomy. We're going to take out your frontal lobes. And the doctor says, okay, the operation is tomorrow. Here's an address. There's a party there tonight. Go and have yourself a good time. You know, there's girls there and stuff before you get this operation, because after you have the operation, you're a vegetable. So he goes to this thing, and it's not a party. It's a recruitment center for the government where they're skimming off talent from the population but keeping the government secret. And he gets recruited into the government. He sees what's going on, and he gets really appalled by it, and then he launches this rebellion. He leads this rebellion. It's a great story, and it's totally appropriate to the way, and TV plays a big role. Everybody like watches TV and gets zoned out, right, on this mush. And it's very interesting to me that it's like a story within a story, that you can't find this video, Harrison Bergeron, in any of the blockbusters or any of that kind of stuff, because it sort of holds the conceptual key to what's actually going on in our society. Very dangerous stuff.
And K, N, O, now. Well, as the years went on, people started to know what he was talking about. You know, eventually.
Now it's,
at Enron. Everybody talks about
this Enron scandal.
Yeah.
It's all there. If you want, I mean, you can actually see it in the corporate press. You just read the details.
After every G, U, every guest that Frank has on the show ends up talking about the same thing, which is this.
What's the source?
No.
The power structure.
M. A, no matter what their thing is, if they're like a farmer, if they're a musician, if they're a poet.
Let's trace it back to what's really the core of the problem here.
Yeah.
And it's about who controls, who makes the decisions, the fact that it's not democratic. And I'm not saying that if there were popular democracy and there was great citizen involvement, that that automatically solves problems. But without that, we don't know what people are actually thinking. If you never get a chance to sit at the table and make your contribution, we don't know what your perspective is. And there's a huge section of the world's population, the majority, who are excluded from a seat at the table. So what the movement is doing is, it's saying, look, when these big decisions get made, there's two basic questions. Who's sitting at the table? Is it a monocrop of just the millionaires? Or is it the biodiversity of the human family, the human bouquet? Little Richard, the rock and roll singer, says, all the races are God's bouquet. I like that idea. The second question being raised by the global justice movement is, what are the values? What are the values guiding that decision-making process? Is it money, make profits for corporations? Or is it meet all social needs and save the environment? Those latter values, those life values, are going to win. We're going to win because nature bats last. Nature's the home team. Always. No exceptions to that. Human beings are one species here for a short blip of geological time, and we have this opportunity to either get in tune with nature and flow with it like surfers do, or to try and put wind in a box, you know, and try and make right angles out of everything. This is crazy. It was an experiment that shot its wad. It's now at the end of the paradigm, and I think humanity is emerging from its adolescence into adulthood.
Yes. I am having F-R-I-F-R-I-O-N. Fritjof Capra.
Oh, Fritjof's great. Yeah. His book, The Web of Life, is one of the few books I've read twice because it was just so good. And he shows, look, there was this paradigm that dominated our thinking, very mechanical, rigid, control nature, make money industry, workers are there to just be drones, oh, that whole paradigm. And now we're making a transition into a life values paradigm out of that money values paradigm. And in any transition, you can see it. I gave a talk to the League of Women Voters the other night, and their document on global economy and trade, you could see one leg of it, one piece, was still back in the 1970s, free market, oh, free trade, all this. But then the newer part that was written more recently was about saving the environment and about workers' rights and human rights. And you can see they're sort of torn, and there's this contradiction. It's like somebody riding two horses. So people have this sense of transition and shift, and what we need to do is to say, that's okay, go with it. Let's make the shift. Let's go to life values. Let's subordinate commerce to life instead of the other way around. It'll be a much better world. It'll be a happier world. It'll be a world without starving children and without clear-cut forests.
When H.E. L. Helms T. A. T. A. R. Targeted A. Artists He used S. E. He used sex, but what? But who? He targeted were artists who were P. O. L. Political who used R. Who used eroticism
to control people.
Well, they used eroticism to make political statements, the artists that Helms targeted. Yeah. And so what he did was he focused on the sex and acted like the other part of it wasn't going on.
And there's two ways to use sex. There's the way that the corporations use sex to sell stuff, to get you to buy stuff you don't really need. I always like those things like, you know, a half-naked woman selling snow tires. What does snow tires have to do with a woman
Whenever
in a bikini?
Whenever we see stuff like that, Frank says, and I get shit.
Yeah. Whereas we're into sex as a liberatory, as something that opens up possibilities, not restricts people's possibilities.
Yes. Yes. They. Them. That. Is. The. R. E. A. The real. T. R. E. A. Reason. That was the real reason that the artists were targeted, was for that, their political subversiveness.
Yeah, yeah. Using sex the right way instead of the commercial way.
Right.
Ooh,
yeah.
No, that's bad.
They were G, A, gay, or women, or me. Frank was one of them. It's either gay, women, or disabled.
Troublemakers.
Troublemakers.
Yeah, right. If you rock the boat, somebody's going to come along and smack you in the head. But see, I see that as a sign of success. Whenever we get repression come down on us, that's a sign that you're doing the right thing.
Yes.
It's like hitting a nerve at the dentist.
Yes.
Ow! Oh, you know you're on target.
You did see it as a sign of success. A lot of the other artists got bummed out and burnt out and said it's keeping them away from their art. Yeah. And Frank said, hey, you know.
Gandhi had a great saying where he said, first they ignore you, then they denounce you, then they repress you, and then we win. So we're at the repression stage, so next is we win. I tell this to young people out when we're getting tear gas at the World Bank and things like that. It's like, no, This is not a sign of their power. Yeah. This is a sign of our power and their weakness that they have to resort to this. If they were really powerful, they'd come out to the public. They'd say, here are our views, here are our beliefs, our values, and here are our policies. And everybody would say, oh, wow, that's brilliant. We'll follow you. But that's not the way it is. They got to come out and shoot people and tear gas you and beat you over the hell to try and corral us like sheep or goats. No. That's not a sign of power. That's a sign of weakness.
Yes.
So we actually are winning. We are making progress in the struggle.
I and they could not do any, they could not do anything to me. Well, when that investigation was going on, because Frank didn't get any money from the government, he just kind of always, like, just whatever money we had, that's the money went into the art. None of the clubs that got money from the government, except for one, ever booked Frank because he was a troublemaker. So he had nothing to lose, so he could just kind of, like, go with it and use it as an opportunity to reach more people.
Yeah, it's like in our organization, we don't get government money or corporate money. Okay, that means we get less money and we have to be more frugal and our salaries are lower and we got used equipment. But it means, what are they going to do to threaten us? And we've had times where, for example, the government hassled us around our trips to Cuba. And they say, oh, you know, this is against the law, blah, 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 and we're going to come down hard on you. And our attitude was, bring it on. You want to try and do that? Okay, fine. If you think you're going to... And intimidation only works if there's somebody willing to be intimidated.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's really important for people to understand. It's actually a sign of victory when they try and intimidate you.
I am always ready to D-A dance.
Yeah, you got to be ready. You never know when the opportunity is going to present itself, so you got to be ready.
I always say, Frank, they don't know how much fun you're having over this. I P R P E P R E D predicted Helms 1 10 years before, but I did not think I am important enough to be one of the ones. Well, 10 years before that, Frank was telling artists, he's saying, you know, everybody's trying to censor each other. The women are trying to censor this group. The gays are trying to censor this group. And he predicted that there's going to be a Helms that comes in and just kind of takes advantage of that.
Divide and rule.
Yeah, yeah.
They're great at that. I mean, we need to learn from that. Unite friends, divide adversaries. We can't let them divide us.
Yes.
I've seen this happen in movements. It's very destructive.
Yes.
Where people start fighting amongst themselves. We can't have circular firing squads. We need to be clear on who the enemy is. And that's why this earlier analysis of the structural analysis is, what's the source of these problems? Let's look at who's up on top, who's pulling these strings. Let's focus on them and taking their power away. Let's not fight with other people who are down here with us, who have very little power. That's what they want us to do. And I think the model they use is what they do in the prisons. You get the black prisoners, the white prisoners, the Latino prisoners fighting each other. They're not going to unite against the warden and the administration. Well, they do that in a larger society as well. And we can't let them run that game on us because it's a scam.
S. H. E. Shell game.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same old thing of, like, hey, keep people confused, keep them distracted. And that's what we got to focus on, is getting people centered and paying attention to what's really going on.
And it is not C. It is not C. H. E. L. M. Helms. It is not Helms. E. I. Either. It is not Helms either. Mm. What do you mean?
Not just one person?
Mm. Is that what you mean? It's not just one person? Mm. It was the L I the liberals.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's like people saying, oh, if only Gore had been elected instead of Bush. Well, I think if you look at Gore's statements, he would have been bombing Afghanistan as well. These guys are part. It's like there's two factions within the corporate elite. One is a little bit more sensitive to labor issues and the environment, and the other is just full out, go get them, kick their ass. But it's still corporate power. They're still beholden to corporations running our society. So until we get somebody like Nader or somebody who's actually critical of corporate power, we're not going to get at the real source of these problems.
H. E. Helms is the B. A. Bad. C. O. Cop. In. B. A. Bad. Cop. Good cop.
Bad cop, good cop, yeah.
And then the one liberals are the good
cop. One slaps the hell out of you, and then the other one comes in and says, hey, come on. So that's the way the elections are done. You get the Republicans, you get 8 years of Reagan. Ah, God, all this repression. Oh, hey, well, okay, you know, we'll give you Bill Clinton for a while. And oh, okay. Well, in fact, if you look at the 8 years of Bill Clinton, it was eight more years of the Reagan-Bush right-wingization of the country. Who destroyed the welfare system? It was Clinton. It wasn't Republicans. It was Clinton, the liberal Democrat. So I think if you look at it actually historically, right-wingers like Nixon, Nixon was the one who did detente with the Russians and the Chinese communists. Because his right wing is cooled out, he can move a little bit to the left. A liberal like Clinton, his left wing is cooled out, he can move to the right and implement right-wing policies that otherwise would have been resisted if it was a right-winger doing it. So they're constantly playing this tough cop, nice cop game on us.
H-E-H-E-Y, hey, at least U-S-T, I still have W-E. At least you still have welfare.
Yeah, but like 3 million people have been purged off the rolls. And there's been some studies done of the women that were forced off. What kind of jobs do they have? And they're the most menial, dead-end, no-career kind of jobs.
But J U S just think if the B A the bad if the bad cops had it would have been worse.
Yeah, yeah. They could wipe it out totally and really.
But that, he's saying that's the way they kind of justify it. They say they'll say it like that. Well, it's bad. What Clinton did was bad, but it could have been worse if it was.
Right. But this is the scraps off the table approach. Yes, it's like, okay, I hit you five times, and that hurt, but I could have hit you 10 times.
Right.
Well, how about you hit me no times, okay? Right. How about if we rule, not through repression, but through dialogue and understanding?
F-R-E-E, freedom, is not some thing that is given.
It's taken.
Yes.
Yeah. You only get freedom by standing up and demanding it and taking it. It doesn't get given. If you look at all the major advancements in our civilization in terms of women getting the right to vote, the end of slavery, the 40-hour work week, Social Security, unemployment insurance, that was stuff that was a result of mass struggles of people going out in the street and fighting for it. People got killed. The women who pushed for voting rights got spat on. They had stuff thrown at them. They were called names. They were trashed. Didn't stop them. And so the ones who started that movement died before they saw it come to fruition. That didn't stop them from doing good work. So I think the consciousness we need right now is the consciousness of let's say the masons who laid the first layer of the Great Wall of China or those cathedrals in Europe that took 300-400 years to build, you know that you're not going to see the end result of your work, but you do really solid work because there's going to be a lot of weight come on it. So we alive right now are responsible for laying the foundations of a future democratic global economy with no starving children, no military, no clear-cut forests. That will happen. The question is it going to take 150 years and disaster happen first before we wake up, or are we going to get out there and do the education and mobilizing to get people to do it before we actually have to have massive disasters, even worse than today, and head it off before it hits? Because it is coming. You see it in the biological collapse of all these different environmental systems, the groundwater, the ozone layer, ocean levels rising, severe weather events, etc. It just goes on and on.
G.
The signs are clear.
E. N. E. Genetic engineering.
Yeah, they could be in unleashing already stuff that we don't know. They're doing a massive experiment with us as the guinea pigs.
It makes atomic bombs look
mild in comparison. Yeah. Well, but that is another case. The government is now preparing a mountain in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, spending billions and billions of dollars of our tax money. Free market? Oh, wait a minute. Free market means you don't want the government involved in the economy. They're using the taxpayers' billions of dollars to build this storage facility so that the nuclear waste from privately owned energy companies can be stored in Yucca Mountain, Nevada at taxpayers' expense. And it's going to get stored for hundreds of thousands of years and not leak out into the environment? I doubt it. So they're doing this massive experiment, and whether you look at that, whether you look at chemical intensive agriculture, the bioengineering that's going on, they are messing with us. They're messing with our planet, the commons, the human commons, and they have no right. That's ours. It's our property.
M-I-K-E. I keep... A, asking, why, B, E, because, they, L, I, live on this planet.
Yeah, but they see, but they think that they're buffered. And they think they're different from us. It's an elitist consciousness. When I lived in Washington, the thing that shocked me the most was I would wear a nice suit with a nice attaché case to penetrate and, you know, to do interviews and see what I could find in terms of documents and stuff. And you would hear things on elevators where it made you realize they think that it's okay for them to make decisions over our lives for us as if we're little children. Oh, you know, the ignorant masses. Hey, no, that's okay. Don't think of me as some ant that you can step on or push aside. The notion of democracy, it comes from two Greek roots, demos, which means people, and kratos, which means rule. People rule. We're supposed to be a republic. Republic comes from two Latin words, res meaning thing and publica meaning of the people. So a democratic republic is a double referent to the people are supposed to rule. Do the people rule? The people don't rule. So you got this promise of democracy on the one hand, and then the actual fact is it doesn't fulfill the promise. That's our job as citizens to make that happen.
A. M. I. Amy. Amy Goodman. G. O. Got. On. In. To their P. Oh, into their party. Did you hear that? She got into one of the parties.
She's great at doing that.
And she got actually into a conversation with a guy that she was recording the whole time before he started to realize maybe she wasn't one of the elite there at the party.
Yeah, she did that with Chevron. She got one of their people in Nigeria to admit that Chevron provided the helicopters to take in a group of police in Nigeria that are called the Kill and Go, because they come in and they kill and then they go. Chevron provided the helicopters to fly them in to a demonstration, a protest against Chevron facilities in Nigeria, where they killed people and then split, these military police, and Chevron provided the helicopters. And she got this guy to admit it on tape. And, of course, afterwards, there was this huge hullabaloo. We actually had a meeting with Chevron executives, it was their PR department, over in San Francisco before they moved out of San Francisco. And it was very interesting to see. They brought in five of their people, and we had five people representing different organizations, Global Exchange, CBE, different community environmental groups, etc. And they had to so tightly control this meeting and so tightly control what was portrayed that at certain times, when certain members of their group would start to say something, their ice queen, the woman that was running their show, would cut them off and say, "No, no, no, wait, we're not going to say that." And they wouldn't allow us to ask questions. And at one point, I naively asked like a follow-up question to what one of these guys said. And she cut me off. She said, "We said no questions." And it's like, wait a minute, you're totally controlling the situation and you're not allowing any questions? We weren't taping it or filming it or anything, but even just for the possibility of the truth coming out to the five of us sitting there, they even brought in a judge to supposedly mediate the meeting. And it wasn't like we were negotiating, it was just a conversation. And this judge then kept intervening and stopping the normal flow of dialogue. And you realize that if you can't allow a normal human conversation, the most basic connector between human beings, to just run its course, you're pretty uptight. There's something you're hiding, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very shocking, even to me, and I expected it to be bad.
U. T. O. U. Tough, T-O-U-G-H, T, T,
tough T,
tough,
thought,
you thought 2 hours would be too long. It's been over 2 hours.
Touche. Point well taken. I underestimate my own bullshitting capabilities. No, but I'm used to doing more commercial radio where it's like these short time segments.
You.
So.
You were T R A I. You were trained.
Well. It's a pattern. There's a group called the Mainstream Media Project up in Northern California, and they get me on mainstream radio. So if I'm doing a Christian radio or a right-wing, I did a thing in Louisiana, it was a network of 13 stations, but it's this, you know, compressed and very tight, hostile interviewers, somebody else on there in the studio who's hostile to you. So, one, there's a lot of tension. And, you know, I have my Bibles out and, you know, I got all my materials out and stuff. And you're ready, you know, for anything they might throw at you. Because what you get is you get guys who will call and say, "This guy Danaher sounds like a communist, but I agree with him. He's World Bank, IMF, they're bad institutions." So you find out there's a real mixed ideology out there where people, yeah, they've been brainwashed with all this stuff. But if you come to them with the facts of how these institutions actually operate, you can penetrate that helmet and get inside there and say, "Well, wait a minute now. Yeah, you've been told this, but let's look at what's really going on here." And that's particularly rewarding when you reach people who otherwise you would think, "Oh, there's no chance that we're going to convince them." And you get them to open up their mind a little bit. That's really rewarding. And I think that's what this is about, is we have to mainstream this struggle and mainstream the message. Because we're the ones that are putting out the truth. The clowns that are putting out all the Nike commercials and all, that's a load of garbage. And I think a lot of people know it.
W-H-I, which is why I do... To two-hour interviews.
Because you can get into the depth of the issues, yeah, and really explore stuff, yeah.
I and E X expand the concept, the F R the frame, the interview frame.
Yeah. If you look at the stuff on TV, it's all so compressed. The news is snapshots. It's a bunch of snapshots, a plane crash, a train wreck, a murder, a rape, and then a puppy story and the weather and sports. It's guns and puppies, basically. There's violence, and then there's a little kitty cat puppy story at the end. That doesn't tell anybody anything about understanding reality in order to change it.
on my show, they have to watch 2 hours to get the nude people.
To get the good stuff. Yeah, right. It's a brilliant strategy.
F-U-N, funny, but the C-O-M-P-L, the complaints, E, the complainers, do watch those 2 hours to get to the stuff they can complain about.
They probably tape it and then edit out the political stuff and then complain about the nudity. Yeah, it's like, I like the model of the right-wing minister who sits on the anti-pornography commission. He gets to look at it all and enjoy it and denounce it. It's the best of both worlds. Right. So what I say to people is, if you're living in a rich country like the United States and you're not working to change the inequality in the world, you're like that minister. You're benefiting from the inequality in the world, but you're saying, oh, yes, I'm against inequality. No, but you're not really doing anything about it. So it's like the definition of hypocrisy. It makes hypocrisy have a bad name, you know. So we need to, you know, walk our talk, sort of.
Okay, so on come the nude girls, huh?
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
T, not really. Yeah, I know. Not really. B, E, because it's too late. We've gone through our 2.5 hours, so we only have time for the closing song. Well, maybe next week.
There's always next week.
Tune in next week. And so it's been Kevin Danaher, Global Exchange, www.globalexchange.org. I want your M.A. T, your mate on sometime.
Medea.
Yes.
Yeah, when she's in the country.
Uh-huh.
I want her. I want her in my bedroom once in a while. That's what I want. She's on the road more than she's at home. I'll tell her.
Right.
Yeah, she's great.
How? P, how does that work?
What we do is tag team parenting. I go away, she's at home. I come home, she goes away, and I'm the parent. So our daughter has, you know, alternating single parents, but she's very
well
adjusted.
But what about you two? How often are you two in the same place?
What it means is when you are together, you really appreciate each other and you make the most out of the time you do have together. I'd say in the past 6 weeks, we've been together maybe 3 or 4 days, 3 or 4 nights that we've spent together. Because our travel, she was in Afghanistan, I went to Brazil, I came back, she went away, I went to Amsterdam, she went to Vancouver.
And how many years has it been like that?
Let's see, 84, so that's about 18 years we've been together. We met, we had one date, and we moved in together, and that was it. Mm-hmm. It was just, it was love at first sight, and we've been together ever since. Very faithful to each other.
Yeah.
It was one of those very lucky.
Oh, both are a radical. Yes.
Yeah, and, and one of the ways it's great relationship is we both write, and if your mate, if your loved one says, this second paragraph is jive, get rid of it, you know, get rid of it. It's the best editing you can get because you trust that person. They have your best interests at heart.
Yes.
So we've really benefited from each other's editing skills. In bed a lot of times, you know, hey, read this, hey, put it aside, take your clothes off, you know. But very productive in more ways than one.
I have even want I even want your kid.
Yeah, okay, I'll ask her. That's a tougher one. She's kind of quiet. I don't know how she'd do in an interview.
How is a how is it being R A raised by
two radicals? Well, our older daughter's at UCLA. She's finishing up at UCLA. She's doing fine and wants to do international human rights work. And our 11-year-old wants to be the first woman president of the United States. I don't know where she got that from, maybe from my wife, but she's pretty serious. She won second place in a contest the other night, a talent contest. She recited the preamble to the Constitution in one breath. That was her act, and she came in second place.
Don't she know P-R-E-S-I presidents? The president is not where the power is.
Well, she's 11, so, you know. Yeah. She sees that as the most powerful position. That's what she wants to do. Yeah. She once said, well, I think I'll be president and then I'll be governor. And we said, well, usually people do it the other way around. I'd be governor first. And she said, oh, okay, well, then I'll do it that way. So she has a sort of casual approach toward power positions. So we'll see if she keeps that as she gets older. But it's the gumption that's the good thing. She's got big goals for herself, so that's good.
Okay. Your player is going to stop, and you need to hit play again. This is Lover. Oh, and before we close, the Frank's new theme song, Totalitarian State by Buster Poindexter.
Frank lost his theme song for a year was Fuck the War. We had this Irish singer-songwriter girl on the show, and she sang this song. This is a year.
TV. They said they had taken over when I was asleep. Well, they were breaking down doors and purging and burning people just like me. I fixed the drink, I switched around the channels, that was all I could see. Oh, it is such a boring feeling when you find that you're falling to a total. You just don't feel so great. Well, the queens were all camping and the kids were all laughing down at the detention center. They didn't see that they were there. I couldn't find one dissenter. I didn't feel communal. I was incommunicado. I couldn't see it getting any better. I couldn't call no one. I wish I had a gun. I couldn't even send a letter. It's such a boring feeling when you find that you fall into a totalitarian state. You don't know what's left. It don't seem right. You just don't feel so great. It's such a funky feeling when you find that you fall into a totalitarian state. You don't know what's left. It don't seem right. I fall into such a fate. When they came to get me, I'd hope they would forget me. I tried playing dead. I finished my drink, assessed the situation, pulled the covers up over my head. I quit. Sensitive to other people's needs, and of this we are proud.